Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Roseanne Brown, author of the new book, Serwa Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting, which is the first in a new series. Brown's debut novel, A Song of Wraiths and Ruin, was published in 2020 by HarperCollins, and the novel was a New York Times bestseller. The sequel, A Psalm of Storms and Silence, was published in November 2021. Best-selling writer Rick Riordan wrote about her new novel. Rosie writes her characters with such lyrical power, wit, and empathy that you can't help falling in love with Serwa Boateng, her family, and her friends. Roseanne, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Absolutely. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about your new novel yet, Serwa Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting, how would you describe the novel?
So I like to describe this book as Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets Mean Girls. So our main character, Serwa Boateng, she is a 12-year-old Ghanaian immigrant. I was born in Ghana, so I have a lot of connections to the culture and the country. And she has been raised to hunt vampires her whole life. Like, her parents are hunters. Like, it's all she knows how to do. However, when a hunt goes horribly wrong, her parents are like, this is unsafe. You can't do this anymore. So they leave her with some non-magic relatives in central Maryland while they go finish their mission. So Serwa now has to face her toughest battle yet, middle school, because she knows how to, like, break a man's arm and, like, how to, like, hold a vampire in a headlock. But she doesn't know how to open a locker or how to navigate, like, the lunchtime politics of, like, who's the mean girls, who can you talk to? The book is all about her kind of navigating the trials and tribulations of your average middle school while when coming from this warrior, like, fighter mindset.
That's great. I'm curious, do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write the novel?
Oh, so definitely. So way back in ancient 2019, a whole different era, it feels like. I had just come back from, I had been teaching in Japan, and I had just come back to America. And I was feeling very kind of like, oh, what do I do? What should I work on next? I'm feeling kind of lost here. And I get this email from my agent. She's like, hey, I was talking to this editor, and like, she's looking for pitches for new ideas. Like, do you want a pitch or something? I was like, yeah, sure. Like, move the editor. And he's like, Steph Murray at Rick Riordan Presents. And I was like, Rick Riordan Presents? Because I am an OG Percy Jackson fan. I got my copy in 2005. Shout out to the Scholastic Book Fair. And I have loved his work, loved what Percy Jackson has done for mythology and for students for years. And so I had not written Milgrain at the time, but I was like, no, I would love the chance to work with him. And so I did a bunch of research, and I got this idea based off the Aje, which is a creature in Ghanaian folklore, which is a vampire that instead of turning into a bat, it turns into a firefly, and it takes over people's minds. So when you're possessed, you become a vampire instead of it biting you and become one. So I got this idea for a story around the Aje and then Serwa, who fights them, and I pitched it to Rick Riordan's Present, and the rest is history.
That's great. And I'm curious, how has the experience been working with Rick Riordan Presents?
It has been amazing. Like, the whole team is so, so dedicated to, like, not just, like, publishing these stories, but, like, really understanding the cultures behind them and, like, the research that makes each one different, because they've done from, like, there's an Hindu mythology, Korean, so many different cultures around the world, and, like, each one has their different nuances and their histories. And so they've been so, so good about, like, learning the specifics of Ghana and why, like, certain things are done in a certain way in the book because of, like, for certain cultural reasons, and, like, really making it, like, this is not just, like, oh, let's just, like, put it out there and we'll just treat it like every other book on the shelf. Like, no, like, there's cultural specific things to each one in the line, and they're so respectful and good about honoring that.
That's great. And I'm curious, can we go back for a moment? What was your initial writing journey that led you to writing your first stories and eventually getting your first novel published?
Ooh, so for this one, we have to go way back, actually, to, So I was born in Ghana, like I mentioned, but when I was about 3 years old, my dad had a chance to study at Howard University here in the D.C. area where I'm from. And so we all packed up our bags and we came here with him to America. And when I got here, I could not speak English, like, at all. And for the first couple of years here, it was actually a big issue as I was coming to school and I could not understand anything, to the point where my teachers called my parents and then they're like, we might have to hold her back because she can't follow directions. She can't keep up with the other kids. Like, we don't know what to do. And of course, like being held back in first grade, that's really embarrassing. No one wants that to happen to them. So it was a big struggle. My parents were really worried. And in the end, it was because of books and reading and writing that I finally was able to understand the language. And like that helped me not just love writing and want to be a writer, but like to connect to other people and like connect my first friends with other kids who are always at the library reading and like hassle do we had in common and to be able to talk to them about. And so from a young age, I knew I wanted to sort of write books that did that for young people the same way my favorite books did that for me.
And what were some of those favorite books during that time of your life? Do you remember?
Oh, definitely. So a big one, I love Gail Carson Levine. She's most famous for Ella Enchanted, but my favorite by her is David Knight. I'm a big fan of Diane Wynne Jones, The Chronicles of Chrestomanci, Anna Morris. Anna Morris was a big, big one I loved. I think my first like story ever all the way through in English was like a big Animorphs fan fiction, basically, because it was like me and my friends all in the Animorphs world. So yeah, very much copyright infringement. But yeah, I still have it.
That's great.
That one and A Series of Unfortunate Events. Yes, that Lemony Snicket, that was the one I loved.
Yeah. Well, you did mention growing up in Ghana and moving to, as you described it, the wild jungles of nowhere, Maryland. I'm curious, I mean... What was that change like for your family? I mean, that's a pretty big change. I mean, as you just mentioned, I mean, you couldn't really speak or understand English.
Yeah. So I always like to describe it like that because I always like to kind of play around with people's expectations. Like, oh, people have this idea like Africa, like full jungles. I'm like, nah, man, I was having a great time in Africa. When I got here, suddenly everything was wild and different. But yes, when we got here, it was very much just that culture shock, you know, because even though I was so young, I was still old enough to recognize that something had very big had shifted and things weren't the same anymore. And when you're, for anyone, going from a place where, like, you understand, like, the culture and the people and the way it works to a new place with different rules and just different logic and, like, just different unspoken rules there, like, that's a big shock for anyone. And so I think that's one thing I really want to like kind of show within the book, like showing Sirwan, like she's older than I am, than I was when we came, but still that anytime you're kind of going from this bubble or this place where like your culture and the way you were taught to see the world is your norm, and then you have to learn to adjust to a new norm, how jarring that can be.
That's great. And I understand that you also scripted a new Black Panther graphic novel that was released earlier this year. How was the process for you going from narrative fiction to writing a comic book script?
Oh, gosh, yes. So I love, love, love comics. Like, comics were actually a big influence on Sirwa as well. But with, the graphic novel's Into the Heartlands. So with that one, my editors at Marvel, Lauren Bism and Caitlin O'Connell, they were actually really good because they worked with so many people who started on prose and then they moved to comic writing. So they had like a whole guide ready and they had a lot of experience like where prose writers, our biggest thing is we're very wordy because like we have to be. Whereas as comics, like the art actually does most of the heavy lifting. And so it was learning to really think visually. Like, so for example, a scene where like I'd be writing out a long description and things to really get the reader to envision it. I actually had to learn to pull back on that. And in the art direction, I'd be like, okay, how do I set up this scene so we don't need as much dialogue so the art can tell the story? Like, when do we just, instead of having a character say like, oh, I'm sad, like we just have a close-up of their face and they're devastated. Like, that gets the message across and it's better. So it was very difficult because I'm actually not a very visual thinker. But I had to, at certain points, I was like literally drawing, scribbling out little comic pages. And I am not an artist. And thank goodness for all the comic readers I'm not because you don't want that. But I would really like just sketch out little panels and just kind of doodle the little thumbnail to show them, to just get an idea in my head so I could describe for the artists what like we needed them to do.
And I'm curious, do you plan to do more comic book scripts?
Oh, I would definitely love to. I definitely have shifted since Heartlands, like I turned in and came out. I definitely, just because I had so many pros in the pipeline, I've been focused on that a little bit. But I would never say no to the opportunity again because I really enjoyed it.
That's great.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And I'm curious about your writing process when you were working on Sarah Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting. Did you outline the novel extensively, or did you just dive into the narrative? How does that work for you when you're working on a novel?
Lots of people have heard that people are like, there's plotters who plot everything out, and then there's pantsers who just kind of make it up as they go. But I actually consider myself a third one that I've heard other authors call it. They call it headlighter or road tripper, with the idea that, like, you know where you start, right? And you know where you're ending. Like, if you're going on a road trip, you know where you're getting, but you don't necessarily know exactly where you're going to stop on the way there. But all you need, like, if all you can see is what's in front of your headlights, that can get you all the way to the end of the trip, if that makes sense, right? So I think that is the best way to think about how I approach story, because I usually will know, like, okay, like, and the character, she's starting the book, like, not confident. The end of the book, she needs to be confident. So that's the end of the journey we're doing here, right? And so I'm usually, like, only I'm thinking a couple scenes ahead. But I'm like, how is this moving us towards a goal? Or she's going to be more confident. She's going to be moving towards this goal. Or is this going to be a setback that pushes her away? She has to push harder for the goal, like, in that sort of way. So I'm definitely a road tripper type of writer. Like, I have my destination, and then I kind of work towards it. But there's always room for little happy surprises along the way.
That's interesting. I'm curious, are you working on another novel now?
Yeah, so I actually just turned in the sequel to Sirwa. I turned that in a couple weeks ago, which I'm so glad for, because I loved not being on deadline. and then I started a YA, and so I've been working on kind of my next series for YA readers, and nothing's been announced yet, but, like, there's some fun things happening behind the scenes.
That's great. We'll wait to hear the announcement. I'm curious, what writing advice would you offer to those who are working on their own stories or novels?
I always tell people, like, don't be afraid to, like, make writing a priority in your life. Because I think the biggest thing I hear from a lot of aspiring writers is, oh, I wish I just had more time, or, like, I just wish I had, like, more space. And, like, the thing is, like, there never is going to be more time, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, I always like to give the analogy, like, if you want to, like, for Olympic athletes to make the team, they have to play at an Olympic level. They have to practice at an Olympic level long before they ever get picked for the team, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm always like, if you want to write to be published, which I think anyone truly can do, but it takes that practice and that time. And the practice for us, it's the writing stories of writing books that some people will never see. And so I always tell them, don't be afraid to treat it like a practice. Like, my friends who are athletes, like, when they had practice time, like, they couldn't even come with us to, like, go out to dinner or to go do things. Like, it'll be like, no, 4 p.m. is when I have practice. I'm not available. So I used to treat writing the same way. Like, back when I was, like, before I had the agent on the book deal, like, I blocked out a couple times a week. That was my writing hour. And during that hour, like, even though I was technically free, if someone asked me to do something, I'd be like, no, I'm not free right now. I'm busy. And I treated it like it was, like, a practice I couldn't skip. And during that hour, all I was allowed to do was write. So I always tell people, like, you're allowed to make a priority, and kind of, if you think in those terms, like, that mindset, similar to kind of like how pro athletes or like pro musicians, like, they have to practice, like, outside performances, it becomes a lot easier then to make time to write, because it feels less like something you just have to sprinkle on top of everything else you're doing, but it becomes an integral part of your life.
That's great. Well, I'm curious, what novels have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Ooh, okay. So I recently went and read Spinning Silver by Naomi Novik, which I loved that book. Like, I know it came out a couple years ago, but I just discovered it and I really, really enjoyed it. And another one that I read recently is Hi, Kirsten Light. Love her work. She is so amazing. She's done a lot of work in Kid Lit, but this is her adult debut. So that was an amazing one. And a third one I really liked. So this one's not out yet. It's out next year, but it's Blood Debt by Terry Benton Walker, which is like a sort of a generational, a story of like different generations of magic feuding families in like New Orleans. And features sort of like Black kids discovering their magic and their power. And I know it's cheating to say a book that's not out till next year, but it is so, so good. And I want everyone to pick this up when it gets out, when it comes out.
That's great. We'll look for that. Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your novels?
Definitely. So my website is on roseanneabrown.com. That's Roseanne, R-O-S-E-A-N-N-E-A, Brown. And then on social media, my handle is at Rosie's Rambles. That's R-O-S-I-E-S, Rambles, with an S at the end. And that's Twitter, Instagram. On both of the two, I'm most active. And usually there's updates on my book and my work and whatever TV show I'm yelling at with my dog.
That's great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Roseanne Brown, author of the new book, Sarah Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting, which is the first in a new series. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Roseanne, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot for doing this. Now, stay tuned for a brief excerpt from the audiobook of Roseanne Brown's earlier novel, A Song of Wraiths and Ruin.
Abra'a, Abra'a, come and gather. A story is about to begin.
The griot's voice warbled through the scorching desert air, cutting through the donkey pens and jeweled caravans that populated the tent settlement outside the city-state of Zoran's western gate. On instinct, Malik angled his body toward the storyteller's call, his grip tightening around the satchel strap slung across his chest. The griot was a stout woman, nearly a head shorter than Malik, with a face stretched wide in a tooth-bearing grin. Bone-white tattoos composed of symbols Malik could not understand swirled on every inch of her dark brown skin.
Abra'a, Abra'a, come and gather. A story is about to begin.
The steady rhythm of a djembe drum now accompanied the griot's call, and within minutes, a sizable crowd had formed beneath the baobab tree where she stood. It was the perfect time for a story, too. That hour when dusk met night, and the little sunlight that remained left the sky bright, but the world below dark. The audience sat on overturned crates in between worn carts, checking the heavens every few minutes for Bahia's comet, even though its arrival and the start of the festival of Solstagia were still hours away. The griot called a third time, and Malik took another step toward her. Then another. When the Zorani had occupied his home in the Eshran Mountains, the griots had been the first to go. But the few who remained had carved their marks into Malik's soul. To listen to a griot was to enter a new world, one where heroes danced across the heavens with spirits in their wake, and gods churned mountains into being with a flick of their wrists. Malik's body seemed to move forward of its own accord, caught on the hypnotic lore of the woman's voice. He and his sisters had been traveling the Ojibai Desert for 2 months now, with no company aside from the creaking of the false wagon bottom they hid beneath, the howling cries of the wind shifting through the dunes, and the quiet whimpers of his fellow refugees. Surely there'd be no harm in listening to just one story and letting himself forget for just a moment that they had no home to return to. And no.
Malik, look out!
A strong hand grabbed Malik by the collar and he stumbled backward. Not even a second later, a leathery foot the size of a small cow slammed to the ground right where he had been standing. A shadow passed over Malik's face as the Chipiqui lumbered by, throwing sand and pebbles into the air with each thundering step. Malik had heard stories of Chipiquis as a child, but none of the tales had captured the creature's gargantuan size. Bred to hunt elephants on the savannah, the top of its plated head could have easily cleared the roof of his family's old farmhouse, and the sharp horn protruding from the creature's nose was nearly as large as he was. "Are you trying to get yourself killed?" snapped Layla as the Chipiqui's shadow passed. His older sister glared at him over the bridge of her crooked nose. "Watch where you're going." Reality returned to Malik like drops of water from a rusty faucet, And slowly, the call to story was drowned out by the cries of caravan drivers to their beasts, melodies from musicians regaling audiences with tales of Solstagia's past, and other sounds of the settlement. Several people had stopped to stare at the idiot boy who had almost gotten himself trampled to death, and the weight of their gazes sent heat rushing to Malik's face. He twisted the worn leather of his satchel strap until it bit into the flesh of his palm. Shadows flickered in his peripheral vision, and Malik squeezed his eyes shut until his head hurt. "I'm sorry," he muttered quietly. A small head surrounded by a cloud of bouncy dark curls popped out from behind Layla.
"Did you see that?"
exclaimed Nadia. His younger sister's mouth hung open in wonder.
"It was like a million feet tall. Is it here for Solstagia? Can I touch it?"
"It's most likely here for Solstagia because everyone's here for Solstagia.
And don't touch anything," said Layla. She turned back to Malik.
"And you of all people should know better than to just wander off like that."
Malik's grip on his satchel strap tightened. There was no use trying to explain to his older sister the power a call to story had over him. While he was prone to dreaming and wandering, Layla preferred logic and plans. They saw the world differently, in more ways than one.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.